Mr. Jim Spradley is a child of sharecroppers from South Georgia. He is a World War II veteran, a successful businessman, and a family man. There's so much we can learn from the generations of our parents and grandparents, but we have to take time and listen. As a former history teacher, I was enamored with the opportunities to use primary source documents, artifacts, and the spoken words and stories of those people who lived in the history I was studying and teaching. Mr. Spradley was 91 and 92 at the time of the interviews. His stories are fascinating and inspiring. The interviews were informal, sit-down discussions in Mr. Spradley's living room. There was not a script to be followed. He sat on his sofa and I was in a chair across from him. One of his dogs was on the couch with him. If you are a teacher, my hope is that you will be able to use Mr. Spradley's memories to help create engaging activities for your students. If you are a history buff, these talks are just what you are looking for. If you are a student, listen and learn from the lessons of life. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Jim talks about his military service and World War II.
The last time we talked, we kind of finished up. You were talking a little bit about school and a little bit about liking school, and then that the problem with going to school was that your father lost part of his labor. That kind of took you away from helping around the place.
Yes, right.
And
it wasn't so much that, it just he couldn't afford it.
To lose you?
Yeah. As far as, going to school. But back in, that was, would have been what? I graduated in 40, didn't I? I mean, 30. Excuse me. No, that's not right. He just couldn't afford it, he said. You know, with the labor. I guess it is. He needed me on the farm. That was part of it. And the other part was that it wasn't fair to the rest of the family because it was too much of a drain on him.
Right.
Okay.
So kind of what I wanted to do was kind of pick up from... where we kind of left off, we're getting close to you're getting ready to go to end up in the war.
Okay.
And I was wondering if we could talk about how old were you when because you enlist, don't you? You signed up for the draft, but you enlist.
No, I was drafted.
You were drafted.
Drafted, yeah.
And so you end up in the Navy.
Yeah. And that was kind of an unusual thing, Steve. We were in Atlanta, going up for our physical, and everybody was in line to go to get in the Army. And I was at the tail end of that line, and the other line for the Navy was extremely short. And a guy came up and said, "Why don't you get in that line?" And I did without knowing what it was. So after we got in there, which was fine, I had no problem because I had two uncles who served in the Navy, and so when we finished that, it was kind of unusual to hear the guy say, "Well, fellas, you'll go over it or under it. You won't lay down and wallow in it." So that was my first experience in being a Navy man.
Wow. I like that too because of the line you got in. Tell me a little bit about. So, do you remember how old you were then? Because they changed the. Are you 18 then, or?
I guess I was 19 by then. So this was would have been 44, I think, in the spring of 44. So I was born in 23. Could have been. might have been a little older than that.
Gotcha. So the in order to and it, was this in Atlanta where you went to?
Yeah, to be drafted.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
And so, how did you get to Atlanta to report to stand in the line?
I'm assuming that the draft paid our way.
So you took like a bus, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. In other words, the people from, I was living in Macon, and the people in Macon got together, and they went up, as I recall. I don't know. I don't remember that.
I know I wasn't drafted, but when I had to go from, I was in the National Guard, Florida National Guard, when I went into basic training, they all had to report to a bus. Terminal, they bust us all to this place. Yeah. But, tell me a little bit about, so when you get into the, as you go through your training and they're going to end up in 40, you end up in the Pacific Theater, correct?
Right.
And can you talk a little bit about what that was like coming from? Because
well, what I guess I need to explain there was that I finished a boot camp and then volunteered for storekeeper school.
Yes.
So I went to storekeeper school and finished that. And there was a guy down there that was my buddy, and he was kind of street smart, and I was what you might say book smart. So, you know, I helped him. He copied my grades when we were having tests, and he looked after me when there was something to be had. So, but anyway, when we finished storekeeper school, a guy came by, an officer, and wanted to know if there was anybody who wanted to volunteer for submarine service, and nobody did. And then he asked if anybody was interested in motor torpedo boat training. And Steve, at that particular time, there was a rumor among the Navy that you know, you didn't really want that duty, because if you did, you wouldn't have any children. And I think that was because, you know, the little boats were extremely fast, and traveling over the waves like that. But it occurred to me that that if we could get into a motor torpedo boat training, that would delay our overseas service another 3 months. You know, that's what those classes lasted. And so I talked to him about it. I said, let's get into that. And so we volunteered for that, and they sent us to someplace in Rhode Island off the Narragansett Bay. And we spent the 3 months there. And then they loaded us up and took us all the way across the states to Shoemaker, California. And that was a shipping off place where they collected the troops until they had a boatload.
Nice. So when you did shipped off, and so, I mean, do you remember how you kind of felt? I mean, coming from Pinehurst, Georgia, or were you living in Macon at the time?
I was living in Macon.
You're living in Macon at the time, and going from Macon, and now you've gone to Rhode Island, and you're going to California, and now you're going across. I mean, were you thinking about kind of this world you're seeing?
Well, it wasn't. It was just kind of a you know, you were waiting, doing time, and I don't recall it being anything that I apprehended or was concerned with. It was just, you know, day by day, you did what they told you to do. And finally, they collected a boatload, I guess, and they loaded us up on a troop ship, Well, it really was an old-fashioned passenger boat ship, I mean, boat. And we got ready to depart. And Steve, one of the most, I don't know what how to explain it, but we were, that afternoon, it took most of the morning to get the boat loaded. And then we started out and sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow.
And it was just awesome. You know, you you didn't know what to do or what to say or any, well, nothing you could say. You just looked and wondered, you know, would you ever come back? Because here you were sailing under the bridge in this wide open ocean, and it was finally you were hitting the real thing.
And you end up in the timing of this is after, as you're heading out, this is after Midway, after
yeah.
And so when you get out there, do you remember kind of what, because you go to the Solomon Islands?
Well, we went through the Solomon Islands, and then I came back there after they assigned me to my ship assignment.
Gotcha. So about how long did you, were you out there for about a year? The war?
No, almost 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. Now, that would show up in the book.
Yes.
My daughter had my actually orders from my that part of it, if you've noticed it in the book, that part that she copied was my record that the government sent me one day for I had been in Eastman for a while, and I read somewhere that any veteran could get a copy of his record if he wrote for it.
Oh, wow.
And I did, and that was what I got.
Oh, that's nice. No,
now my daughter still got that.
It's very nice. So what were your kind of, you know, as you're there and, you know, the war's going on, because I know what were your, can you talk a little bit about what your thoughts were about what, you know, about just being there?
Well, it's kind of hard to remember. You weren't really overly concerned. You just figured, you know, the Lord would take care of you, I guess. And but we landed. They dumped us off as we left the troop ship. They dumped us off on an island, and we had to stay in, use our Navy gear. You know, you slept in your hammock, and at night you had to put up a netting for the mosquitoes so they wouldn't eat you up. And you know, we were there several days, and I'm assuming, now this is just my imagination, that the captain or the guy that was in charge of all of the troops on the island was trying to keep them busy. So every morning we would go out for some reason or other, he wanted us to build a dam out of this stream that was running down. And in retrospect now, it wasn't a place to build a dam. You know, there was nothing flat on either side to tie it. But we worked on it and worked on it. And finally, I blistered my hand, really serious. And just as we were getting ready to leave, my arm had red streaks running up it.
Oh my God.
So they put me in sick bay, and everybody left me. So I was the only guy on the island. So finally, they were able to dismiss me from sick bay and put me on a ship. And then I sailed around trying to catch up with it. And finally, I got the PT boat supply, USS Pontus, Pontus.
Gotcha. And so working in the supply on the Pontus, what What did you take care of? What did you do? What did you make sure was taken care of?
Well, pretty much everything. We payroll and supplies for the troops, for the ship, I mean.
Right.
And I was storekeeper third class, and I was kind of the head guy. There was a couple of other guys, but they weren't they hadn't got they were enlisted men, but I was the equivalent of a chief, you know, in the army or whatnot.
So did you have to make requisitions that came from other places?
Yeah, every once in a while they let you know that a supply ship was coming through, and so you were able to order the supplies you needed, the things for the commissary and the things that the troops might need.
Gotcha. Now, I want to go back just a second, because once your health got better after the infection that took place.
My hand.
In your hand, yes.
Yeah, it was, they dismissed me from sick bay, my hand was well on the way to mend. And I bruised it one time because in traveling, when a ship would come by, I don't know who did it, but somebody would assign me to be on that ship. And I was climbing up and down trying to, you had all your gear wrapped up in your sea bag. I don't know whether you've seen the way the Navy traveled or not,
yes.
But we had, you know, these, I bruised it and it started bleeding, but it didn't give me any trouble. And once I landed on my ship, it got well real fast.
Gotcha. Like you were saying that you were the only one left at the island, they actually got you back to the original ship you were supposed to be on.
Yeah.
That's what I was trying to find out, is if they really got you back to that
Well, now my original ship, that was, when you say original, that was my assigned ship.
That's what I meant. Do you know how many, did you see lots of sailors coming and going, or did you work with the Navy and Marines, or the...
No, we didn't see many, but our ship was kind of usually fairly close to land when we anchored and let the little ships go up and do the attacking.
If you worked with a lot of seamen and the sailors and the Marines, and if you had a lot of interaction with a lot of...
Oh, no, we did not, except that occasionally we would haul, this is where I left off, we would haul, 10 or 15 army enlisted men would get on our boat, and we would take them from this area down to another area. It was kind of interesting because we ate pretty well because we were on a ship and we had our supplies, but we just ate so much mutton because that was down there where that was what was available and below the equator. But it was amazing to see them eat the stuff that, you know, the meat. It was okay. It tasted like mutton, you know. But that was pretty much it. We did not see anything much except in two particular times. When we got to Hollandia, I think that's the way you pronounce it, in New Guinea, place you mentioned early on? We were cleaning up the, The turn of the war, if you've read anything at all about it, basically, you know, that the United States was left with nothing after Pearl Harbor, was it Pearl Harbor? Yeah, when the Japanese attacked us and wiped out our ships.
Yes, yes.
It just pretty much destroyed us. We didn't have anything to fight with. And we got, later on, they were able to break the Navy code, and so that when we the next attack at Midway, I think it was Midway, where we fought and actually brought them down to our size.
Yes.
And we sank a couple of aircraft carriers and a battleship, I think. And so we stayed there then to mop up the little areas where the Japanese had hidden out, or at least were anchored out. And then after that, we went to the coast of New Guinea and worked our way up toward the Philippines.
Gotcha. Okay. What your duty to do along this way is to help make sure that the supplies are there, that the you're just kind of making sure that the what was your duty at that point when you're going through and you're working your way to the Philippines?
Oh, it was to keep the ship supplied, and we had about 10 little PT boats, and they had certain requirements.
Gotcha.
So we had to supply them with their products. When they weren't fighting, they were anchored alongside of us.
I gotcha. Okay, so that's the Pontus.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I kind of want to go back to something that you said when you were talking about the mutton and eating when those army soldiers were there with you, they hadn't had, I guess, meat.
No, they'd been eating sea rations.
Yeah, so
yeah,
I bet they were excited about it.
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't care what it was.
Oh, they were to them that was heaven almost, I guess. But it was amazing to see how well they enjoyed it.
So, when the war comes to an end, or at least your time comes to an end, you come back to the States, and what was that transition like? Trying to come back from the Navy and to get into a new...
Well, it was a little bit kind of discouraging. It felt like I had, as a matter of fact, I think in the book it said, you know, that I, one day I was down below checking the stock so that I could fill the next order, and the yeoman who was really the secretary to the captain came down and said, you know, you're going back to the States. And I thought he said we were going back. And I was really, really happy because, you know, I could see now we were on our way back to the States to get out of the action. And but then he cleared it and said, no, you're going back. So I said, well, you know, I won't go because I'll stay and help. My responsibility is right here. So he called me up, the captain did then, and said, first time I'd ever been in his office, but he looked at me and he said, Spradley, he said, I'm on a, in the morning, your ass is going to be on the way to the States. He says, I'm not going to let you make what might be, probably will be, the biggest opportunity you will ever have. So the next morning I was packed up and ready to go, and I left them. And it took several days of, you know, sailing from here to here, to here to here, and, you know, just sort of piecemealing it together until I got to Hawaii. And they put us on an airplane, and we flew back to California. And that was, then they gave me, since I was headed for Princeton to the V-12 program, I was early for the next class, so I had almost 30 days of vacation. So I visited my girl who was in Boston, and my brother was in the Navy at Great Lakes in Chicago, and then I went home and visited Mom and Daddy for about 2 weeks, and then I reported to Princeton on May 1st. And that was for a refresher course where there was a bunch of us Navy guys who had been selected for the V-12 program and give us an opportunity to study so that we could keep up with the little guys who had never left college.
Gotcha.
And
so is that what V-12 was?
Yeah, that was pre-V-12, if you will. And during that time, on May 7th, Germany surrendered.
Do you remember what that, because I want to come back to the Princeton experience, but do you remember what that felt like to know that part of the war was going to be over with?
Going to be over?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You just sort of felt like at this particular point, that was all we needed, because now we could concentrate on one side. Before, you know, we were fighting two wars, Germany in the Atlantic and Japan in the Pacific.
So when that is announced, are you up in New Jersey? Is that where you are at the time?
Oh yeah, I was at Princeton.
Do you remember, we were
going to school for 2 months and. For that refresher course. And it was kind of overwhelming because we were walking around the campus there, and the girls from the town, for the life of me, I don't remember the name of the town right now, where Princeton is located, but anyway, that was it. And they came in and picked us up, and, you know, we were celebrating. Because they were affected because their husbands was in Germany probably, so it was really a couple of days there that things were kind of not uproar but just in a celebration mode.
And that's what I was curious about, what it was like, that feeling. People wanting to celebrate.
Yeah. And you just knew then that it was a matter of time. You know, how do we wind it, wrap it up? But
do you remember hearing, or whether the president of the United States, or whether it's MacArthur, do you remember anything about when you'd hear some of the big figures talk, maybe through the radio or through the newsreels, about what was happening at the end? Do you recall experiencing any of that? Maybe what?
Yeah, well, we were. It was part of the conversation, and being at Princeton, you heard a good bit about what was going on. They had a cyclotron, and I'm not sure I know what that was, but it was a wheel that just rotated, you know, awfully fast. And Princeton was also working on experimenting and things to do. And one of my biggest, I tell folks, one of my biggest experiences was, you know, meeting Einstein.
Wow.
Now, he was studying there at the Institute for Advanced Study, and that was part of, I mean, it really wasn't. Princeton didn't have anything to do with it, but they were using Princeton's graduate school facilities. So the people who were really putting the atom bomb together was working there. I'm assuming that they were there. They didn't tell us that, but that was a real secretive. And Einstein would walk across the campus. And he was typically, if you ever saw the picture of him, he looked exactly like that. And several times I crossed the campus a little bit to be able to walk with him for a while. And I would, you know, I would catch up with him, or he would catch up with me. And I would say, you know, nice day or something like that. And he just grunted. I was never able to involve him into a continuing conversation. Two or three times he did say, you know, okay,
wow.
Take care. But it was, that was, to me at that particular time, was really great.
Well, that's awesome. That's, and it's, because it seems like you were persistent trying to see if you could get a longer conversation with him.
Yeah.
Also. Nice. So let's talk a little bit about, so you're at Princeton, and you eventually finish with a degree in economics from there?
Yes.
Excellent. So, so is that part of that program that leads to the economics?
No. We were studying. I had one year, my education was one year before I entered the service. And then I had 1 year of V-12 training. And then they dismissed us. Or at least I could have stayed in, but I would have had to sign up for 4 more years. So what I did was then switched over to the GI Bill. And Steve, one of my biggest moments at the during the service was in 1944. I walked by the bulletin board, and there was a sign on there that said that Congress had passed a bill that the servicemen would get a day of education for every day they served in the service. And man, I just felt all the difference in the world. I had, before then, I was just doing time. But after that, I knew then that my education was guaranteed if I survived. And before that time, I had never ever thought about, you know, whether I would make it or not. It just didn't cross my mind. But to answer you, let me go back a minute and just mention something about it. We were, at times, we weren't particularly in intensive fighting. But when we got to Hollandia, New Guinea, that was real rough. And they'd shoot at us and we'd shoot at them. But, we just kept moving up the coast toward Japan, and the next place was the Philippines, and that was really tough when we got in there. The islands were just at night every ship would be standing guard, you know, and of course we stood guard during the day, but during the night you could see those tracer bullets. And I don't know whether you know what a tracer bullet is,
yes,
but it was covered with phosphorus, I think, or something, which, you know, it would glow in the air and you could see what you were shooting at.
when that was going on, and you're working with those PT boats to for supplying, right?
Yeah.
And they're going back up into wherever they're going. So about how far would you say? I mean, so you're seeing planes also attacking?
Yeah. And they would, but they were pretty fast, and they, I guess we would put them within, you know, several miles of the place that they were supposed to attack.
Yes. Do you remember what it was like when it was announced that Japan was surrendering?
No, I don't, it was almost a non-event because, Hiroshima had been, you know, completely wiped out.
Right.
And we were, there was a good bit of conversation going on, you know, as to whether or not we should attack that way or whether we should fight our way in. Well, we in the Army, or Navy, excuse me, with whomever, all of us in on our side had pretty well determined that it was going to be hand and fist, you know. I mean, there's no telling how many people we would lose trying to get in and get a foothold in Japan, because the women and the children and everybody would be against us. And so that was when they landed to Hiroshima, we pretty much knew then it was over with.
Gotcha.
But I guess it would surprise us. We didn't. What was the other one?
Nagasaki.
When it was attacked, I mean, it was almost a non-event because, you know, it was already over as far as we were concerned.
Gotcha.
And see, Germany had already surrendered, and then they were sending all their equipment and stuff over to us in our area, excuse me, and we could tell the difference.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and hosts. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends. Take care.